Grab your favorite mug and fill it up with your favorite blend, because we're getting ready to sit down and talk about Southwest Florida real estate. Cottrell Title and Escrow presents The Closing Experience, real estate talk over a cup of coffee. What are my closing fees going to be? Should I rent or should I finally purchase? Why do I have to send all of these documents to get a mortgage? The real estate process doesn't have to be frustrating. Let our experts at Cottrell Title and Escrow help make buying or selling real estate a dream. Here to answer all of your questions, our host, managing partner of Cottrell Title and Escrow, James Schlimmer.
All right. Welcome, everybody, to the Closing Experience podcast. We are here on a topic today that has been requested countless times. We have the attorneys of Grant Cottrell Miller Myers, Aaron Miller Myers, and Mr. Justin Cottrell sitting down for a kind of a no-holds-barred Q&A on the Nabor sales contract. We probably had over 25 questions asked. The attorneys did a wonderful job. We're going to transfer over to this webinar so you guys can listen in as we get started. And as always, we are grateful you took the time to take part in Cottrell Title and Escrow's podcast series. And we look forward to bringing more content to you soon. Thanks so much. All right. It is 12 noon. It is Tuesday. It is Cottrell Title and Escrow's webinar time. This is the topic here by popular demand. We've been asked this for well over a year. Hey, will you guys just do a Q&A with Aaron, with Justin, the partners at Grant Cottrell Miller Myers? And
Aaron's thrilled to be doing this.
This is a little out of my comfort zone.
It's a little overwhelming, right? Because yes. You don't know what you're going to get hit with. We did get some questions in advance, which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. We're limiting this Q&A only to the Nabor contract.
Correct.
So let's preface that. But you guys are in the hot seat. Make no question about it. You don't know what you're going to get. There could be people secretly part of this that want to stump you. But you're brilliant.
And we can get stumped, though. I think that's something that's important to say, that there's plenty of stuff we don't know. Yeah. And if we don't know, we'll find out the answer.
Yeah.
We'll get to you. So.
Well, let's make this happen. Let's go right over here to, again, the lovely Aaron Miller Myers, partner at Grant Cottrell Miller Myers, and Mr. Justin Cottrell. And let's dive right in so we can get everybody in and out before 1 p.m.
Thanks. All right. So do folks know how they can send in their questions throughout the presentation?
We talked about that. There's a Q&A button at the very bottom of the screen. There's the chat box. Any way you want to get those questions in, I'll make sure we can get them answered. And again, we had about 10, 15 questions that came in before, mm-hmm. which was wonderful.
Yeah.
So any way you guys want to start, dive right in.
You're going to shoot us questions?
Aaron's got them.
I've got a few questions. Okay. And I've got a sort of initial conversation starter.
Okay.
So one of the questions that we got was, I typically deal in Farbar land, mm-hmm. and I have a client who wants to purchase property in Naples. And she said, generally speaking, what are the differences between the Nabor contract and the Farbar contract? Mm-hmm. Right. So this is a conversation starter. So, I'll start. So generally speaking, the inspection sections are very different in the Nabor contract and the Farbar contract. If you have a buyer and they are purchasing property using a Nabor contract, they'll be able to inspect for mold, inspect for radon, and as part of the general repair section of the contract, request the seller remediate or request a credit for inspection items.
And in the Nabor contract, the seller has no duty whatsoever to perform any remedial action.
Correct.
On anything, as opposed to the Nabor contract, where they have a duty to perform remedial action up to the contracted amount, generally 1.5% of the purchase price.
Correct.
Another main difference that I tell people is the finance contingency. In general terms, the way I like to explain it is the Farbar contract is really not so much of a finance contingency, but rather a finance due diligence period for the buyer to see whether or not they can get financing. After that finance contingency period, there is no contingency in the Farbar land. In Nabor land, that contingency actually goes throughout the closing. And if you're not able to get the loan, the buyer is able to terminate, receive their deposit back if they show that they've been rejected. So again, very general, we're speaking mm-hmm. complete generalities mm-hmm. here, mm-hmm. but that's a big difference there.
And one more main difference between Farbar and Nabor mm-hmm. with respect to deposit. So the default provisions in the Nabor contract say that if a buyer defaults under the contract, the seller's sole remedy is the deposits made as liquidated damages. Under FARBAR contract, under the default provisions, the deposit is defined as, in the first page of the contract, the deposit is defined as deposits made or to be made.
Yep.
And so the default provision says that if the buyer defaults, then seller can collect the deposit, capital D, including deposits already made into escrow or deposits yet to be made into escrow as liquidated damages.
And just a very quick example of that, in NABOR land, if you have a contract in which you have a $5,000 initial deposit and then a $10,000 additional deposit, and then the buyer never makes their initial deposit, the seller eventually can terminate the contract, and there is really no remedy for the seller at that point because there has been no deposits actually made. In FARBAR land, in the event that the seller does not make their deposit on time, the initial one, the initial $5,000, and time is of the essence for that provision in the FARBAR contract, the seller can hold the buyer in default, and now the buyer owes the seller $15,000 from that standpoint. So,
yes. All right.
You're agreeing. We're off to a good start.
We are off to a good start. Well, this
is going to be a wonderful Tuesday.
I've been looking forward
to this for the last couple of weeks.
Have you? To a seminar where we actually agree?
Yeah.
I just want to jump in. If anybody can jump into the chat session here and just make sure a thumbs up again that you can hear Justin and Aaron. That would be wonderful for us. And I'm also going to do... I love that, by the way.
It's my favorite noise in the world.
It happens in podcasts all the time. And everybody's like, you're drinking.
Yes.
It's a Diet Coke. I figure maybe a disclaimer, right? If certain questions come across, right, these are hypotheticals you guys are speaking in.
Always, sure.
Right? I don't know whatever else you want to say on that, but that's just without saying.
Yes.
Good to know.
Hypotheticals sure. based on real life questions. Yes. Okay. So another question we sometimes get is, can I use the NABOR contract for my buyer's purchase in Lee County? And the answer is absolutely, of course, you can use whatever contract your client is comfortable with. I have some agents who's typically work in Naples or in Collier County, and they have a client who wants to purchase in Lee County. Their question is, can I use the NABOR contract in Lee County? Yes. The agent may not be comfortable with the NABOR contract in Lee County, so they may reject it or request to counter on the FARBAR contract. Quick note, though, if you do use the NABOR contract in Lee County for your buyer's purchase, same goes with Charlotte County. The buyer gets to pick the closing agent, which is common in Collier County, but the seller has to pay for the title insurance. So I'll say that again. If you use a NABOR contract in Lee County, your buyer gets to choose their closing agent, and the seller has to pay for the title insurance policy. So if you're looking where that information might be in the contract, it is in Standard E, which is the seller's instruments and expenses, and Standard F of the NABOR contract. Cool. No questions in the chat feature, huh? I'm going to keep going. No. I'm going to keep going with the sending questions that we received earlier. This is an interesting one, and it has to do with the financing contingency. So the question is from an agent: can the seller terminate the contract 4 days prior to the closing date if the buyer does not waive the financing contingency? So our financing contingency, let's say your financing contingency period ends 10 days prior to the closing date. I'm just assuming I don't have this information, but 10 days prior to the closing date, buyer doesn't waive the financing contingency, buyer's silent, buyer does not offer a waiver of the financing contingency. The question is, can the seller terminate the contract under the financing provision 4 days prior to the closing?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
One day prior to closing.
Yes. The morning of closing. Yes.
Which is a really kind of sticky area with the NABOR finance contingency here.
Yes, it is.
And buyer does not have the right to, let's just say, day of closing. Seller says, nah, going to terminate. Buyer can't say, oh, no, wait, I'll waive. Or
correct.
5 days. That waiver needs to come in before the termination. There's no time period that you have to waive after they give you the notice of their intent to terminate. Once they terminate, they terminate. This would be an incredibly difficult thing, I would imagine, to explain to your buyer who has all their stuff in their moving truck a few days before closing to let them know that, seller just walked away. So what's the solution? Do you waive your finance contingency? Well, that all depends. There's no right answer to that. How comfortable are you with the lender?
Yeah. So if the buyer waives the financing contingency, what does that really mean? What is the result for the buyer? If the buyer says, yes, I waive the financing contingency.
So it means, one, that the seller does not have the right to terminate after the financing contingency date.
So it cuts off the seller's right to terminate the contract on the buyer under the financing provisions. Okay.
Also, it means that in the event that the buyer is not able to close due to the finance, due to not being able to obtain financing, that any deposits actually made would be subject to seller, would be a remedy for seller upon buyer's default by not being able to close. So all those deposits would be due to the seller at the end of the day. And then the advantage of waiving, though, is that you're able to get an extra 10 days. Is it 10 days?
Yep. Absolutely.
If there's an issue with the lender to be able to close.
We've got a question here at the Cartel Title and Escrow.
A live one.
Alana, whatever. You guys get the thing. Can you ask for an extension to the finance contingency?
Yes.
Absolutely.
In fact, NABOR has a form to request an extension to the finance contingency. Yeah.
And I'd imagine you need written signatures from everybody?
Yes.
Yep. It would be an amendment to the contract is what it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Changing the finance contingency or amending the contract. But absolutely. And that's a great question because that's, I think that's really where I suggest agents go in that situation is to ask for
that extension.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You don't want your buyers in this situation where they don't know.
If I have a buyer that's only put $1,000 down.
Sure.
And they're comfortable with just riding it out, seeing where the transaction goes. They want to prevent the seller from being able to terminate the contract.
Just waive then at that point, right?
Yeah.
Just waive.
We're agreeing again.
We are. This is crazy.
I think you may agree on this one too.
Yes.
Is it really true if the buyer doesn't waive by the deadline, the seller can terminate the contract?
That's 100% correct. Yes. If the buyer does not waive the financing contingency either prior to the end of the loan approval, the financing contingency, or on the expiration, then seller can terminate the contract. So
up into the point that it's waived. So let's just say finance contingency ends on the 20th. Buyer can waive still on the 22nd, 23rd, 24th.
Yep.
At any point, and that extinguishes seller's right to terminate.
Why on earth would a seller want to terminate a contract?
Because they have a better contract.
They might have a better contract. I've heard it's a hot market right now. So some sellers may not think that the buyer is going to be approved for the financing. So I can only guess that that's what happened in this hypothetical real life scenario, that this, you know, seller wasn't comfortable with the buyer's financing. Maybe there wasn't enough of a deposit, or maybe they just got a better offer. You guys, maybe the seller gets a better offer after the financing contingency period is up. Buyer hasn't waived and seller's like, well, I'll take my chances with this cash buyer at a higher purchase price. So the moral of the story is to track your deadlines. Also, track your financing contingency provision. Track that time period. If you have the buyer and you've got a month or two left before closing, maybe see if you can get an extension to the financing contingency period as suggested. Justin?
No, and I agree with that. But I also think that that should also be contemplated in the deposits that are being made. You know, if buyers super confident that they could be able to close on this deal or that they're going to be able to get the loan, or maybe they have cash to be able to close on this in the event that they weren't able to get the finance contingency, then maybe the deposits can be higher in the initial offer to make the offer look stronger. However, if you know they're absolutely dependent on this financing, and if you're not exactly sure that they're going to qualify. Maybe they're a small business owner where it, you know, they need a lot of documents, tax returns. It just sometimes can be difficult. At that point, you might want to have a smaller deposit being made, which the buyer is willing to take the chance of getting financing and potentially losing and compensating the seller for taking it off the market during that time in the event they're not able to get financing and then waive. These are all things that you should be talking about with your buyer.
Before contract.
Yep. It's all very important. But you know, it all wraps in together. The additional deposit is absolutely, or the initial and or additional deposit is an absolute factor on whether or not you should be waiving, should not be waiving, what you should be setting the finance contingency date at. You know, maybe the finance contingency date is 5 days before closing. Mm-hmm. The seller's wait, presumably at least, less likely to terminate during those 5 days when you've already given them loan approval and all those things.
Sure. And if you're the seller, you would want at least 5 days time frame to know whether they're going to be moving forward or not.
Yep.
We got another question.
All right.
What is the recourse if a seller refuses to sign a termination on a legitimate denial letter that a buyer provides from a lender?
Well, so yeah, I think the question. I think the question is refuses to sign a release of the deposit. Let me just clarify that we don't need both parties agreeing to the termination. Any party can terminate. They could be in default at that point, though.
Keep going. Yeah.
So a buyer sends in a termination. That contract's terminated. Now, whether or not the seller signs a release of the escrow back to the buyer, if they fail to do that, the buyer can sue the seller, demanding that they release it, and the buyer would be entitled to attorney's fees under both the NABOR and the Farbar contract. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. Can we talk about that a little bit more?
Sure.
So you were talking about the value of the deposit. So whatever the buyer is comfortable with putting down, whatever the seller is comfortable with having an escrow, knowing that if the transaction goes south, that the seller's sole remedy could potentially be under NABOR. The seller's sole remedy is the deposit made as liquidated damages. So hypothetically, if there's a deposit that's only $3,000, and buyer illegitimately terminates, so they don't have a right to terminate, they're just defaulting, and seller wants to sue buyer for the deposit because
Buyer's not releasing.
Okay. But buyer doesn't have a right to keep the deposit, for example. So for practical purposes, so the title company holding the escrow funds will say, okay, if the parties can't agree as to who gets the money by signing a written release and termination, whether there's splitting the deposit, whether one party gets it, the other party just gives up, whatever. They can agree. Then the title company or law firm can send the funds to the court.
Yes.
So through that mechanism of interpleader, they send the funds to the court. And then what happens?
So it's actually they're filing a lawsuit.
With the title company.
The title company. Yep. They're filing a lawsuit. They're naming both the buyer and seller as parties to this lawsuit. And they're telling the courts, they're saying, court, I have this money. I don't know who it belongs to. There's conflict here. I'm asking the court to take this money from me, put it in the court's registry, and then pay me my attorney's fee for it because the contract tells me that I can do that. So that's what's happening. It's an interpleader lawsuit. And the title company will give it to the court. Both parties get notice. Then they can fight it out between themselves. The title company's out of it. They don't have their money. They get their attorney's fees, and the title company moves on.
So title company's attorney that they have to hire to interplead the funds, their attorney gets paid their attorney's fees from the deposited amount.
That's correct.
Court fees are paid from the deposit amount.
That's correct.
All of that is paid from the deposit.
So back to your example, there's $3,000.
Yes.
In dispute.
So at
what's
the end
left
of the
over
day-
to fight about?
Exactly.
Not
so
much.
Right.
Not much. I would imagine the average cost of for attorney's fees would be $1,500, $1,600. And then the filing fees with the service and everything, you're probably talking about another in between $400 and $700. So now you're left with $700 or $800 for the buyer and seller to fight about.
Yep.
That all being said, the prevailing party between the buyer and seller are entitled to attorney's fees and court costs, all those fees in addition to what's left there. But now you have to collect it. It's just really not worth it.
You have to litigate and fight it.
Right. It's ugly.
So the short answer to their question is the recourse is what Justin said, right? So the mechanism, if someone is not playing nice and the parties can't agree as to the release of the deposit, then the title company or law firm that's holding the funds will send the funds to the court and say, file the lawsuit, interpleader lawsuit, and say, court, let the parties fight it out, leave me out of it, pay my attorney's fees to be able to file this document, and then we're done. For practical purposes, it may not be worthwhile for either party to fight over a low deposit.
Let me ask you this question. If it was absolutely clear, but let's just say the buyer terminates within an as-is contract within the inspection period, would you feel comfortable as an attorney, you're holding escrow to give the buyer back his money without having seller sign a release for that? Let's just say seller was just being a pain.
You're asking the most conservative person in the entire world. No, I would not feel comfortable, but...
And I would, and there's in different law firms and or title companies around here would have different policies on that. Some would say, this is clear.
Absolutely.
I'm not worried about. So what am I concerned as an escrow agent? I'm concerned that the seller could possibly come back and sue me and say, no, you owe me this money because you in violation of the terms of the contract, sure. paid this money mm-hmm. to the buyer when that money should have come to me. If it's crystal clear, in my opinion, and I'm a little bit more liberal, well, maybe a lot more in a lot
of interesting times.
Yeah. than Aaron from that standpoint, she's much more conservative. I would be inclined to go ahead and release that money. But again, yeah. different law firms, title companies have different policies, neither one being necessarily right or wrong. And they certainly are under no obligation if there's not agreement to go ahead and disperse yeah. those funds.
We've got two other questions. Very right. good questions, by the way, too.
Okay.
So this is from Katie. If all parties sign a contract and agree to the terms, but buyer changes their mind and does not deliver their initial deposit, which is not due for 3 days, does a termination need to be signed by all parties, or does the contract expire since the buyer did not perform by delivering their deposit?
Back to what you just said.
Right well, there. So, all right. the contract doesn't expire because time's not of the essence from that standpoint. So let's just say buyer does not give their money within 3 days. What the seller would need to do is give buyer notice of their default, failure to give the deposit, and advise them, give them a reasonable amount of time to cure that default, failure of which the seller will terminate the contract. So in this case, buyer does not give their deposit. Seller sends a demand letter or demand email, something in writing mm-hmm. to buyer saying, you failed to comply with this term of the contract, giving your deposit. We are putting you notice that time is of the essence here, and we're giving you 3 days to receive the deposit, failure which we will be terminate. You'll be in default and we'll terminate the contract, material default. And then after those 3 days, they would give a notice of termination. Contract's done, and then you move forward.
And how would you advise sending that notice? Could that be email, text, phone call? What do you think?
Email at a minimum. I would probably want a written document that would be sent via PDF to agent and them. So, but
can this be done by the client themselves if they don't have an attorney?
It can be. I wouldn't advise it to be.
Not everybody has an attorney.
Sure. So. Sure. 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 It can yeah. be for sure. Yeah.
So then the end result is if they say you're in default because you haven't submitted your deposit, and seller can move on with their lives. I imagine the broker would want something in writing.
So that's what's really kind of difficult, and we've dealt with this a few times, is the broker, in order for the seller to relist it on the MLS, they want an agreement of the termination, where the buyer's under no necessarily obligation to agree to the termination here. And that's something that we generally just have to escalate with broker's counsel and kind of explain to them that this is terminated. We've gone through all the steps. It's difficult. What's necessarily accurate or correct versus what is general practice between the brokers sometimes are two different things. And I do know a lot of brokers want that document for their file that this has been terminated and signed by both parties. But sometimes you can't get it. And I would yeah. suggest that you'd be able to stress that to the broker, where if you can't get it, you can't get it, and you're able to move on.
Do you have a problem with an agent sending that as opposed to – so the question came in, can an agent send this?
Yeah.
This notice, or is that UPL?
I think it's UPL.
It's pretty
unlicensed
UPL.
Practice. Yeah, I think at that point you really need to have the attorney represent them, or the seller or the seller's attorney do that. I would. It's really kind of dicey to have the agent
yeah.
send that.
Yeah,
there's no reason to. You don't want that liability. Agents don't. Mm-hmm. Agents don't need to be getting involved with that. It's the unlicensed practice law. They don't want that on their plate.
Yeah.
We're in agreement.
Oh my gosh, we're in agreement again.
This is amazing.
This is unheard of, guys. We got another question. Time is not of the essence on the neighbor contract. What is an acceptable time and process to remedy, example, missing a deposit or another? Like, what do you guys classify as a reasonable amount of time to go beyond?
I like 24 hours, 48 hours.
Well, and I guess...
But...
Let me be very clear here, though. So time's not of the essence. So let's just say the deposit needs to be made in 3 days. There is no reasonable amount of time after that until the demand's actually made. And time is made of the essence of that. So just because a deposit's supposed to be made in 3 days, and 10 days later, that deposit isn't made. The seller has no right at that point to terminate. The seller only has the right to terminate after demand has been made and time has been made of the essence of that particular breach to make it material for them to then terminate, and then it's reasonable. So the question is, what's reasonable? You know, Aaron mentions 24 to 48 hours. I would imagine that would probably be reasonable in that circumstance. For that to be done for the initial deposit. And it could be,
I mean, different attorneys have a different opinion, mm-hmm. right, of what is reasonable.
Sure. If it was me in that position advising the seller, they were required to do it within 3 days initially, right? So if I gave them another 3 business days, I feel like I'd be, you know, out of abundance of caution, I'd be certain that that would be deemed reasonable because they only had 3 days to begin with. Within 24 hours, why even push that? What needs to be done? You know, what's the extra 48 hours going to buy me? So that's what I'd probably suggest is to give them those the extra time. I would err giving them extra time so no one suggested that it was unreasonable.
Can we go back to where you said ish?
Sure.
So the statement was time is not of the essence in the neighbor contract. And I don't know if you heard Justin, he's like, ish. Sort of. What do you mean by that, Justin?
Well, so I mean by that in, for instance, if buyer does not waive their finance contingency upon the finance contingency deadline, seller has the right to terminate. So when we say time's not of the essence in the neighbor contract, I'm concerned agents believe that
no deadlines matter.
The deadlines don't matter. So if the finance contingency ends on the 20th and the buyer gives their waiver, I can't mm-hmm. speak today, mm-mm. of the finance contingency on the 22nd, but before that, on the 21st, the seller terminates, the buyer doesn't get that wiggle room. That deadline is a hard deadline, irregardless is not a word, right?
Regardless
of whether time is of the essence or stated whether time is of the essence.
So another example of, so if there's a consequence in the contract, so if you don't do this by X date, then something else happens.
Sure.
Right. So if there's a consequence in the contract, then I think it's not one of those scenarios where we say, well, time is not of the essence. It doesn't really matter. So for example, in the inspection period, whether it's an as-is contract or a standard contract, you have the right to do your inspections within a time period. If you do not do your inspections within a particular time period and or make the request for remediation or terminate if you're an as-is contract within that time frame, then you're deemed to have accepted the property in the condition that it's in. So you're not, you can't say, you know, in 15 days to do your inspection and then, well, time is not of the essence, so I'll do my inspection on day 18.
Yep.
And then make my request, you know, 5 days after that. So you, deadlines and timelines do matter, but with respect to entering, you know, submitting deposits and that kind of thing and giving folks notice and an opportunity to cure.
So what we when we talk about time being of the essence, what we're really talking about is what constitutes a material default upon which the non-defaulting party has the right to terminate. And if time is – if every obligation – failure to perform any obligation is always a default under the contract. But the real question is this material? So back to the neighbor example, they have 3 days to make the deposit. Failure to do that is still a default. But is it a material default upon which the seller has the right to terminate the contract? And the answer is no under the neighbor contract because time is not of the essence for the initial deposit. However, FARBAR, time is of the essence. Mm-hmm. Failure to do that is material. Therefore, the seller has the right to terminate and pursue the remedies under pursuant to the terms of the contract.
So we have a couple questions on the demand. So I'm a listing agent.
Yep.
Right. And they didn't make their deposit. Let's just say, great. They're supposed to do it in 3 days.
Yeah.
Now, literally that demand, whether it's an email, can an agent make that demand or are you saying stay away from it?
Yeah, I think you stay away from it. I really think the attorney needs to be the one making that because you're going into the realm of the, you know, unlicensed practice of law.
Can you go deep into, I get a little bit deeper into what is a demand? So for instance, can an agent go, an agent can go to the other side and be like, hey, we're still waiting for your deposit. Can you make the deposit?
So what we're doing is we're really giving them notice that we're making time of the essence for that particular clause. And we're explaining, then we're giving them a reasonable time. We're giving them notice of the breach, letting them know that time is now of the essence and giving them a reasonable time to cure that. failure, which now makes it a material breach. So I'm not sure whether I'm answering your question or not, because I don't want agents to be the legalese with this. I don't want agents to get involved with this in this world, because it's really the consequences of doing it wrong or advising your clients wrong.
To mention that that email can be used against them, because it's like, wait a minute, you're trying to do this.
Yeah.
And dicey. Yeah. So if there's no attorney in the file or there's no attorney part of the transaction and this comes up, this is really where an agent should pick up the phone and reach out, right?
Yes.
Yeah. An agent could say in an email, the deposit was due today. I haven't received it from your closing agent. Do you have the EDV? If your buyer's not making the deposit, my seller may seek legal counsel to discuss the rights. They can make that comment, threat of, my seller's really concerned about getting this deposit in if you if your buyer's not willing to put it in.
Yeah, let's just terminate. Or they can, if the goal is to terminate this anyways, would your buyer sign the termination just so we can get out of this and move on with our lives? Yeah, but to get to the point that you're actually making time of the essence on a provision of the contract and then terminating based upon a material breach, you definitely need an attorney to be the one on that stuff.
In order for, so if the listing agent does exactly what you just said.
Yeah.
Right? Great. How much time would need to go by before the seller can literally deliver a termination?
A reasonable amount of time.
Right?
So all the case law on this, it's a reasonable amount of time. So that's for a judge and jury to determine. Again, when we talked about the initial deposits due in 3 days, I can't imagine any argument to suggest why the 3-day amount of time after you make the demand would be unreasonable. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm not sure any other circumstances there's, again, error on the side of giving them more time.
To make sure
that it's reasonable. But
yeah, I have another question. It's a little off topic, but how can a buyer request repairs for an as-is contract? So we know that NABOR has the buyer's election inspection notice form to use with the standard contract. Some folks have asked, well, I would like to make a repair request, even though I know it's an as-is contract, so the seller's not obligated to do anything. How can I make a request for repairs in an as-is contract?
You want me to answer?
I would love for you to answer. You're doing a great job.
I think you put it on an amendment form to contract. Mm-hmm. So you send over an amendment. The amendment would simply say that seller agrees to repair, remediate, fix, action verbs, right?
Yes. Seller shall
repair,
replace, repaint. If it's something that's an as-is contract, you can ask for all kinds of things.
Yep.
Doesn't mean the seller's going to do it, but yes.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
There's a couple questions that just came in. Again, if there's no lawyer part of the transaction, who notifies is the question.
Can't the seller do it themselves? But it can't be the agent that's giving legal advice that seller, you should do this. It's seller, you should discuss with legal counsel.
Yeah. So I know the agents listening here don't want to hear this, but there needs to be an attorney on the file if that's the case. If there's a breach of contract here and we need to understand seller's rights or buyer's rights, depending on what side we're on, at that point, you need to get an attorney involved for sending that notice. Again, I realize that's probably an unpopular answer right now.
And it doesn't happen that often,
no,
to be honest. It really, most of the time when the parties enter into
it. It happens a lot with additional deposits.
Yes.
A lot of times people won't make their additional deposit until they get back, the buyer's elections and everything with the NABOR contracts. So we do see that a lot. But I would highly, highly, highly suggest that agents not be making these demands. That doesn't mean you can't be sending an email saying, this deposit was due here. We haven't received it. I haven't seen any notice of receiving. Yep. What's going on? Give me a status update and inquire. But to make demands that would have legal consequences is simply the unlicensed practice of law, and agents should stay away from it.
Mm-hmm. And also, it's possible that if client or agent start down the, I'm going to threaten termination and that kind of thing. It's possible that the buyer could say, whoa, wait a minute, I got to get my deposit in. Or buyer's like, well, I was wanting to get out of the contract anyways. I'm going to find that loophole now. But either way, it's moving the transaction in a direction. But you definitely don't, realtors really, don't need to be dealing with.
This is a two-part question.
All right.
Why are title companies doing permit searches if it doesn't affect title?
Excellent question.
It's a great question. I'd love not to.
Start there. And then it's, well, what do you do in post-closing if it's not closed?
Okay. As a service to our clients, title companies and law firms are ordering permit searches.
And this is relatively new.
Yeah.
Phenomenon in the title world. Fortunately, we were not operating what we started kind of like 7 or 8 years ago. So we were pulling.
I would say it's maybe like late 15 we started. It was like this became almost the norm. Mm-hmm. Definitely 16, 17 all the way through.
Yeah. And the reason, it just kind of changed the landscape in the whole closing world kind of changed where you had these companies that were out there that were pulling all this permit data. And now new buyers were buying these places and seeing that there's open permits. Mm-hmm. And then the seller saying, hey, when I bought this 3 years ago, why didn't my title company tell me about that? So, go ahead.
But also, agents can order title search or permit searches.
Sure.
But they aren't. So I think it's a good service that title companies are equipped to be able to do. It is an easy, for us, it's sort of an easy way for us to navigate. We aren't going to order a mold inspection or a general inspection of the property, but this, because it is dealing with paperwork, not with the physical inspection of the property, it is something that we are able to do.
It certainly makes sense for the title company to do.
Yes, yes. I can understand and empathize with folks who think that we're just digging up more problems. But from this perspective, if nobody wants to be in the position 5 years from now where the buyer, whether it's our buyer or the selling agent's buyer, says, there are permits on this property from 15 years ago. Why didn't you find them?
Yeah. And I'm just speculating here. I could be wrong, but maybe also the reason it's happening now and it wasn't before is the ease of access to this information, which still isn't always easy. We have some properties that we have to look at like 3 or 4 different databases to see whether there's open permits for the last 30 years or so. But I would imagine, 15 years ago or 10 years ago, you had actually had to go down to the municipality offices themselves and find out that information. Now that information is readily available, title companies, it's standard practice for title companies to pull that information now.
However, if folks start, if agents and sellers, when they list their property, go ahead and pull that permit search at the very beginning and they address all the permit issues up front, whether it's a permit issue or that might turn into a code enforcement issue, or if there's unpermitted improvements, they know that they, enclose their garage without a permit or something like that, and they want to start that process of obtaining the permits, they can do that on the listing side. And then you've got, presumably a few months to be able to address it rather than under the timeline of a 30-day closing to try to address it. And by really, it's probably more like 10 or 15 days to address it once the buyer's completed their inspection, submitted the buyer's election, that kind of thing. The post-closing question, can you repeat that?
Permit's not closed.
Yes.
But can we still close? And then what do we do with post-closing as far as the 200% or any of those things?
Sure. And I guess your question is presuming that the seller agrees to fix that open permit.
Let's make that assumption.
Sure. She can still close. There's no issues with closing or issuing a title policy pursuant to the terms of the contract. 200% of the cost of remedying.
Of what though, right?
Yeah.
Right. So this is the problem. So seller agrees to close out an open permit or obtain a permit for an item that was not permitted, and they can't get the work completed prior to closing. They can't get the final inspection, can't get the county to come out, can't get the certificate of completion. So the contract says in standard D2B that the seller shall escrow 200% of the estimated cost of completing the remedial action, including the closing out of the permit. And if I'm a buyer's attorney, I'm going to go with the maximum amount of the value of the work, for example. And if you're the seller's attorney, you're going to say, what is the cost of the paperwork to file with the county? Mm-hmm. And so it takes the parties to be reasonable and make to get the transaction moving forward. What is the figure that the clients are comfortable with escrowing? Now, part of the sales contract says that no matter what the sum is that they escrow, let's say Justin's adamant that it's only $500 that the seller is willing to escrow. My client wants $5,000, but fine, we'll agree to $500. In the sales contract, it says the escrowed sum is not a limit on the seller's liability. So if it ends up costing $2,500, it's the seller's responsibility to fork over that money to close up the permit.
I think it's also, I'm sorry.
But it's harder to chase down a seller after closing to force them to put more money, you know, into escrow or to pay something after closing. So,
and I think it's also important to point out the buyer's obligation and duty and seller's obligation and duty to close is not contingent upon whether or not that permit has been closed out or not.
Or any repairs completed.
Or any repairs completed. So the buyer cannot say, oh, I'm not closing until this gets done. And the seller, on the same token, can't say, I'm not escrowing 200%. I'm just going to extend closing. Neither one of them have that right to do. Their duty to close is not contingent upon any repair item being completed or permit being closed out or obtained.
We got another question.
I'll take it.
All right. In an as-is scenario, if the buyer asks for repairs informally, seller agrees to make some minor repairs, but there is no addendum or amendment to the contract. Seller makes some of the repairs, but not all. Can the buyer make any demands at closing or after?
No. We're shaking our head pretty loudly. No.
So the contract specifies in there that any changes must be in writing and signed by the parties. On top of the statute of frauds that requires that, but what the contract states that.
What I could imagine happening is, for example, the seller through their agent says, "Yeah, we'll fix these things," and if the agent says in writing, by email to the other agents, seller will fix these things, meaning all presumably all the things, and only fixes a few of the items, then perhaps buyer could say, well, I did not terminate my contract in reliance on your agent's
detrimental reliance theory.
On your agent's assertion that the seller would fix these items prior to closing. But always get it in writing. That way you're clear.
I think that'd be tough too, but
yeah.
The contract specifically states that everything must be in writing. You would have to be able to prove that the buyer reasonably relied on that to their detriment. And is it reasonable reliance that a seller just says they're going to do it and not putting in writing? I think that'd be difficult to prove. So
maybe. But if I have a buyer who's really unhappy the week before closing, they may find a way out of the contract. Sure. They may find a way out that would allow them to keep their deposit, and that's not good for anybody. I mean, the goal is to close the transaction and manage the client's expectations. So if you have someone who says, I am not interested in purchasing this house if this carpet is still here. Yeah. I want the carpet to be replaced. Put it in an amendment to contract. Seller shall replace the carpet with whatever prior to closing, or seller shall provide a credit at closing for the replacement of the carpet in writing, signed by the parties. Period.
This is my question here.
Yeah.
You guys are both representing the buyer. What's the number one way? You don't have to go number two, three, four, five. What's the number one way you look to try to get the buyer out and get their deposit?
HOA disclosure.
Or condo docs. Yep. So if the property is within an HOA, which the chances are pretty high here in Collier County that the property is within a homeowner association or in a condo association, if the seller has not delivered the HOA disclosure prior to contract execution, then the buyer has a 3-day right of rescission. So if the seller has not provided the HOA disclosure prior to contract execution, the buyer has a 3-day right of rescission. If it's a condo, the buyer hasn't received all 7 pieces of information that are required by standard I of the contract, which is the declaration, the articles, the bylaws, the frequently asked questions, the rules and regulations, the most recent year in financials, and so those are all specific to the association, and the governance form, which is a standard document. So if they haven't received all seven pieces of information under the NABOR contract, buyer has the right to terminate the contract. For a seller, the best evidence of receipt of those seven pieces of information is the acknowledgement of receipt of condo documents. So you as an agent know you've delivered them to the buyer's agent, send it along with the acknowledgement of receipt of condo docs. That way we're eliminating that possibility of termination. On your HOA disclosures, make sure they're correct. So if you have a listing that you take right now, September, October, November, December, and for some reason it doesn't close, it doesn't go under contract until January, February, you better update your HOA disclosures, because every year there's some change. Even if it's just a few dollars here and there, there are changes to the HOA disclosures. So make sure you're providing the up-to-date HOA disclosure.
Take a breath. Wasn't that pretty good?
That was worth a lot. The price of admission alone. I just felt like Justin had a lot of speaking parts today, and I haven't really said too much. So
this is unusual.
This is very unusual. Yeah. You enjoy the fly by the seat of your pants questions, and
we got another question.
I came ready today.
You did.
We got another question. What's up? Hey, is an email as good as an addendum or amendment for repairs?
No.
Is an email good enough? They said addendum, but they really mean amendment. Is an email as good as an amendment for repairs?
No.
No. Well, that right, depends. So that depends. So because it's not an amendment or an addendum here, but when we're talking about the NABOR contract, we have what's called buyer's elections and seller's responses. So those elections and responses could be made via email, because we're not talking about changing the terms of the contract. We're just requesting and responding. So in those circumstances, I think there could be a very good argument to be made that those are, even if they're not signed, acceptable correspondence between the party that would change their rights there. So you're saying
it's not 100% required that they use the buyer's election seller's response form.
That's exactly right.
Right?
It just says buyer shall request.
Yep.
And then seller shall respond.
Sure.
And it does not require those requests and responses to be signed.
It just say written.
Yes. And written is email.
Yes. Yes. But back to what you said earlier, the contract cannot be modified.
That's correct.
Except in writing, signed by the parties.
Yep.
Period. So that's under standard R. So yes, if you're just providing, I suppose, the buyer's election notice or something under a standard contract, sure. But you still want to give them the list of items, use your verbs, say what you want to have done, and then accompany with the inspection report.
Yep.
Or if you're requesting a credit, what do you have to have? The estimates. Yes. Okay. Cool.
We got another question.
I love that.
So if after the inspection period, there's a flood or major damage to the property, can the seller cancel?
No. What do you mean?
Can the seller cancel? I know that threw me off too, because I was expecting to be buyer, but can the seller cancel?
Yeah.
Well, it's actually a great question, because the seller is now responsible to repair or escrow 200%. Yeah. So in FARBAR land, either party can cancel if it's over a certain amount? There's a question mark behind that.
In FARBAR land, the seller's obligation to maintain the property if there's a casualty event, so weather event or force majeure type event, is capped at 1.5% of the purchase price. Is that what you were getting?
No. Okay. Nope. Go ahead.
Seller has a duty to maintain the property. Oh, I see what you're saying. Maybe. If the seller – so – why are we talking about FARBAR? Can we talk about that next week?
Yeah, that's fine. Okay. No, seller cannot terminate, which is a very – it's a great question, because – specifically with the seller, because what this question is bringing up is a real hardship potential on the seller. again, for this example, let's just say we have a $500,000 house with a screened-in enclosure, and a hurricane comes and it knocks down that screen. And we all know those screens cost, call it $60,000. After a hurricane, there's nobody there to be able to put back up that screen. And let's just say it's not covered by insurance for this example. So now seller needs to escrow $120,000 at closing in order to close this deal to be able to put that screen back up.
And pay off their
$450,000 mortgage that they have off. So no, they don't have the right to terminate. And it really could create a hardship for seller here. And presumably, and this is another presumably the house isn't maybe worth $50,000 or $60,000 difference, whether it has that screen or not. They would rather just terminate this contract, list it for the same amount without the screen there, and not have to come out of pocket, you know, for the $50,000 or $60,000. So no, they can't. I think that's a flaw in the neighbor contract, that they're required to essentially fix all of the related, all of the casualty related stuff under their duty to maintain, and failure of which they have to escrow 200% of the cost.
Yes, except ish. So seller has a duty to maintain the property through closing. Seller's risk of loss. Seller shall maintain insurance on the property, which is an interesting provision in the contract. Seller shall maintain all existing casualty, wind insurance, and flood insurance until disbursement on the transaction. And there are some folks out there that don't have insurance on their property. So I would consider putting that in other terms and conditions that seller is not going to maintain insurance because they don't have insurance on their property. Anyway, so if as a result of the casualty, including flood, buyer is not able to obtain hazard, flood, wind, or homeowner's insurance, or they're not able to obtain the insurance at a reasonable rate, this is the force majeure-like clause in the contract. Buyer may delay closing until the date that is up to 5 days after the coverage becomes available. So I don't know what causes flood. I'm just assuming that it was
hurricane.
Rising waters. Hurricane. Yep. Yeah. If the coverage is not available and or the essential services for closing are not restored to for a period of 30 continuous days after the date of the flood, either seller or buyer may terminate this contract. So this is if they can't get insurance because of the flood and it continues for 30 continuous days, then either seller or buyer can terminate the contract. But also, so the other ish, I keep pointing at you, the other ish is if the loss, the flood, renders the property uninsurable or uninhabitable, then it says then either buyer or seller may terminate the contract. So if it's just a little flood that doesn't so severely damage the property that would make it uninsurable or uninhabitable, then yes, seller has a duty to maintain. Seller shall, you know, repair the entire property. But if we reach the level of uninsurable or uninhabitable with documentation that says this cannot be insured because there's, you know, 3 feet of water standing at the bottom of the property, or it doesn't meet the local building codes anymore because of whatever flooding, then either party can terminate. So yes, but if an extreme example, they can terminate. Do you have another question?
I do, but we are breezing through. We are 10 minutes left,
oh
by the way.
Oh my gosh.
And the whole hour went by so fast.
It did.
So your nervousness was unwarranted because you guys are doing a tremendous job. And I'd just like to say, you know, Cottrell Title and Escrow, we love bringing you the attorneys of Grant Cottrell Miller Myers, Aaron Miller Myers, and Mr. Justin Cottrell. I just want to point out, if you've never closed with Cottrell Title and Escrow, we'd love the opportunity to earn your business. And with that, I'm going to go to the next question.
Cool.
The hot water heater blows up and causes thousands of dollars worth of damage prior to closing. Mm-hmm. Can the seller cancel?
Assuming that the property is not uninhabitable or uninsurable, No, they cannot, and they need to either fix it prior to closing or escrow 200% of the cost to fix it.
And I think the fix or escrow is actually the buyer's election, at the buyer's option. Hold on 1 second. So the seller's maintenance obligation under standard D2C, if seller fails, seller shall. Okay. So if the seller fails to perform seller's maintenance obligation, essentially making sure the property is in the condition that it was in during the effective date, then seller shall, at buyer's request, either perform the repair. They can do it prior to closing. If they can't do it prior to close, the buyer says, I want you to fix it. And he's like, I'm trying, but I can't do it prior to closing. Then escrow the 200%. Otherwise, buyer could elect to receive a credit in the estimated amount for that repair item. It's pretty great. I've got another question. So we have open permits from 13 years ago on shutters that no longer exist. How would you advise to proceed? This is back to the why are we even bothering with permits anyways, but this is a pretty common scenario. So do you want me to jump in?
Yes.
Okay. So if there are open permits on the property, let's assume that we have the seller in this scenario. Because the buyer's requested the seller to close out the open permit and seller says, okay, fine, I will do it. But now what? What do they do? First thing I would do is contact the contractor. Second thing I would do is contact the county. But in this instance, if the shutters are no longer in existence, it's a very easy process to reach out to the municipality and say, hey, there's an old permit. These no longer exist. Can you please send someone out to visit the property to confirm these shutters no longer exist? Let's close them out. Let's close out the permit. So it's a simple cancellation form.
A lot of times, too, there'll be an open permit for HVAC unit that no longer exists. So what, they come out there. So yeah, I didn't jump in on this question because I really don't know the answer at all. So you call up the municipality.
Yeah.
They send somebody out. They realize that there's what the permit's regarding doesn't even exist. Then they just go and they administratively close it out.
Or correct. So the property owner would still have to. I don't think they have to pay a fee.
Okay.
They just have to submit a cancellation form. They say this work no longer exists or it never existed. So they pulled a permit and then never installed the fence.
Gotcha.
For example, they say I need to cancel this permit, and then the county will come out and inspect. And say, you're right, there's no fence there, or you're right, the shutters do not exist. Let's go ahead and close it out. Now, the AC unit is interesting because every 10 or 15 years, the AC unit is likely replaced. So if you have an old permit from, you know, let's say the 90s or so, and you know that the HVAC unit was replaced within the past few years, and that permit was closed, you can typically provide the new permit to the county and say, hey, can you just go ahead and administratively close out this old permit for the HVAC unit? Because there is an air conditioning unit, but it's not the same one that was installed in the 90s. So pretty easy process. But so typically the first call that I make when there's open permit issues is to the contractor. If I have the seller, I call the contractor, say, hey, why didn't you close out your permit? My client paid you to do this job, all that. Second call is the county and say, what do I need to do here? Or you can send them an email. And we have a whole webinar actually on open permits. Another question?
We got another question.
Okay.
There's a current annual lease, which is assumed by the buyer at closing.
Okay.
Does the lease stay as is and just transfers to the new owner? In addition to the tenant estoppel, is there any other paperwork the seller and buyer have to do? Buyer notifies tenant of new ownership and where to send payments and so forth.
Yeah. So on standard E of the contract is the seller's obligations of documents to provide at closing. They're required to obtain the tenant estoppel. If the seller is represented by counsel, their attorney will prepare and obtain the tenant estoppel. If the title company is closing the transaction, they will prepare and obtain the tenant estoppel. So the idea of a tenant estoppel is to find out exactly how much the tenant has paid to the seller, whether it's deposits, advance rent, cleaning fees, that kind of thing, so that at closing it can be transferred over to the buyer as new landlord. The other document is an assignment of lease. So the closing agent, title company, law firm will need a copy of the original lease that is going to be assigned from seller as landlord one to buyer as landlord two. And that assignment of lease is typically prepared by the attorney title company. And it's a simple document that essentially says, I, seller, have this lease. I'm granting it to you, buyer, as new landlord. And we include on ours the contact information for the new landlord, the contact information for the tenant. And then we have the tenant also sign it so that they are aware that this lease was transferred from seller to buyer at closing.
Great.
Yeah. Cool. I have a question. How can I protect my buyer in the event insurance is unavailable due to an impending storm? And this question is not really a question from an agent because it's a new form that NABOR has, and I just want to talk about it, so I put it in the form of a question. So NABOR has a new addendum called insurance unavailability due to extreme weather conditions, which is exactly what it sounds like. If you have not pulled that form, the NABOR addendum to contract insurance unavailability due to extreme weather conditions, please do that. The idea is this addendum is solving the problem of a buyer being under contract and not being able to bind insurance because Florida is within the cone of uncertainty in the event of an impending storm. So it says, if due to an actual pending or threatened hurricane, tropical storm, tornado, or other extreme weather condition, buyers unable to obtain hazard, flood, wind, or homeowner casualty insurance at a reasonable rate for closing, Buyer may delay the closing date until the date that's not more than 5 days after such insurance becomes available. If the insurance becomes available or remains unavailable for a period of 30 continuous days, then either seller or buyer can terminate the contract. This also solves the glitch in the sales contract where we talk about casualty events. So in the casualty provision, standard D2E of the contract, it says that if there's a casualty event, a hurricane that passes through and causes damage that prevents a buyer from being able to obtain insurance, then the parties can delay the closing date. This is...
Why is that not just in the contract?
Because a contract comes out every 2 years, and this is a glitch fix.
Gotcha.
So the sales contract, when it's revisited, can include this language. But for now, gotcha. We saw a need. This similar language was in previous versions of the Naval War contract, and for some reason it was eliminated when they added the casualty event
gotcha.
Language. This is the glitch, and it will be back in the sales contract.
We are down to 2 minutes. Can you repeat who is supposed to sign the assignment of lease again, please?
Everybody.
Everybody.
Buyer, seller, and tenant.
Yes.
Ideally.
Tenant doesn't
it's
have
really
to sign
just,
it.
It's really the only person who legally has to sign that is the seller because they're signing it over to buyer there. So it's almost like a bill of sale, but for not tangible personal property, but for that license. So really it only has to be technically the seller, but it's good practice to have everybody sign it.
Yes.
Listen, we are here. It's 1 o'clock. So we did the full hour.
Already.
We like
did.
To be courteous of everybody's time.
Yes.
I do believe that based on just the interaction, the success of this, it's possible we do another Q&A with a Farbar sales contract. But hey, we'll see where it goes.
I've got it on the schedule.
That's a perfect thing.
Thank you, everybody. We really appreciate the questions, the interaction. So that makes our much more enjoyable to be up here when we have the interaction. So we appreciate that.
Yes. Tuesday, October 13th. Will be asked the attorneys the FARBAR contracts. We're going to stick
Ooh.
To the
It'll be
the
exciting.
Sales contracts and the addenda. We're not talking about any listing agreements or anything like that. But yeah, it'll be exciting.
Excellent. Thank you, everybody, for taking the time. And we look forward
Thanks,
to seeing
guys.
You soon.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye.
You. It's easier if I don't share my screen.